This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You cannot promise, keep on promising Kenyans while they cannot be able to access basic commodities. And people are hungry, people are angry, they cannot go to work because the cost of fuel is so high. The cost of getting basic commodities in their household is so high, and everything is skyrocketing.
That's Swahili Service reporter Kennedy Wandera in Nairobi on the latest protests by opposition leader Raila Odinga's supporters. Details coming up. Also, Iranian President Saeed Ibrahim Raisi wraps up his three-nation visit to Africa. And Sudan's neighbors meet in Cairo to seek a solution to the three-month-old conflict. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Azimio leader Raila Odinga has called off his much-publicized political rally at the historic Kamakunji grounds. The former prime minister disclosed that the teams who went to prepare for the rally were attacked and their equipment destroyed. He stated that some were arrested by police who used water cannons to chase them from the venue. I reached out to Swahili reporter Kennedy Wandera in Nairobi for the latest.
The opposition leader Raila Odinga in Kenya says that the government of President William Ruto has gone around, turned it around and failed to contain the skyrocketing prices of commodities in the country while people are still reeling from the COVID-19. And therefore, if the government cannot listen to its people, then there is no way that people can listen, they can keep quiet. They will have to continue protesting and going to the streets to tell the government that they are fed up because they are not able to reach the prices of basic commodities in the country.
So people are actually saying we're tired as they blew whistles displaying coordinated messages sanctioned by the Odinga-led opposition alliance. Actually, what started the pushback yesterday, the brutal pushback yesterday by the police?
The opposition has been holding anti-government protests. It started last week, leaving death, serious injuries and a trail of destruction, which was also replicated on yesterday. But the essence of this is that the opposition is saying that they cannot recognize the presence of William Ruto, and they call it as an illegitimate government because they believe they are the ones who are voted to power by Kenyans, something which the administration President William Ruto has thrashed, citing the case that was lodged at the Supreme Court, which vindicated the victory, and therefore he says he's in power through the voice of the people. But Odinga claims that they have information and through whistleblowers who provided information to them that they indeed won the election. And therefore, they're demanding electoral justice and the government, what he calls as the regime of President William Ruto, to lower the cost of living as well as scrap the finance bill 2023, which levies additional taxes on basic commodities. So that is essentially why there is nationwide protest. Friday happened on Wednesday, and the opposition is still saying that they will be doing the same for the next 3 days, beginning on Monday next week.
So now it's not only taxes, but like you just mentioned, Odinga, who has refused to acknowledge Ruto's presidency, despite the Supreme Court dismissing his challenge in September 2022, is asking his supporters to directly exercise power, terming President Ruto's mandate as illegal. So this is like twofold now, the illegality of Ruto and also the tax hikes.
Absolutely. And that has been the gist of the conversation that has been going on, a bipartisan talk between the opposition and the government. Though those talks through parliament have failed, actually they are futile at the moment, and the opposition has been vacated the talk. And those talks were framed around reconstitution of the Electoral Commission, which Odinga says that the process was begun by President William Ruto without consultation from Odinga's party, Odinga's coalition. And therefore, they are saying that there are a lot of things. One, that they wanted the president to work on as an immediate measure is to lower the cost of living and make sure that the common people are able to afford basic commodities. Because remember, when President Ruto got into power, he scrapped the measures that President Uhuru Kenyatta, former President Uhuru Kenyatta, had placed on fuel or on basic commodities. The subsidy that was placed there was completely scrapped, and the president saying that his government is not going to subsidize what he calls as consumption, but rather is going to put subsidies on production. So that has been the cause of the problem here, and the president has been telling Kenyans to wait a little bit because he inherited a wrecked government that has no coffers to sustain the economy, and it will take time for the country to return to normalcy, something that the opposition says is untenable because you cannot keep on promising Kenyans while they cannot be able to access basic commodities, and people are hungry, people are angry, they cannot go to work because the cost of fuel is so high, the cost of getting basic commodities in the household is so high, and everything is skyrocketing. So that is the essence of why they are saying they have to take to streets until the government listens to the people.
That was Swahili reporter Kennedy Wandera speaking with me from Nairobi. Wrapping up a three-nation visit to Africa, Iranian President Said Ibrahim Raisi is in Zimbabwe today, meeting his counterpart, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, as the two countries build on their solid political and diplomatic ties. Kuzaza Nwashi, who is in Harare monitoring the state visit, talked with me about the meeting between the leaders of the two countries dealing with Western sanctions.
I think in Zimbabwe's case, Iran brings its technological advancement. One of the MOUs that has been signed is cooperation in the field of telecommunication, something that Zimbabwe stands to benefit in. And I think from Iranian side of things, it will also be how best they can collaborate and evade the sanctions. Because as you may know, both countries share, they're all under U.S. sanctions. And Zimbabwe has been big on the re-engagement in its foreign policy. So this speaks also to Zimbabwe's foreign policy to re-engage. But if you look deeper into it, this is more of a continuation of former President Robert Mugabe's foreign policy of looking east, really.
Yes, you are right. These two countries established relations with each other actually 40 years ago. This year marks the 40th anniversary since the establishment of diplomatic relations between Harare and Tehran. So basically now, what I would like to know is, have you seen any signatures of memorandum of agreements like bilateral relations, cooperations, particularly in trade, commerce, agriculture, and mining?
Well, there hasn't been much report. The only memorandum of understanding that we understand has been signed so far is on telecommunications, where Zimbabwe will benefit on that front. Tapping into what Iran already has. But the indications building up to the visit was that there will be multiple of these memorandum of understanding being signed. I think also key to note is that Tehran and Harare have shared good relations. They even support each other in supporting Palestine in Palestine's battle with Israel. So that's one thing also to note about the two relations. And also, I think Zimbabwe is moving up in the global scene. Just earlier this year, we had a visit from the Belarusian president, and later in May, the visit was in January, and later in May, we also received a generous donation of helicopters from the Russians. So I think Zimbabwe is really moving up in that front on the global scene and causing up with Russia, Belarus, Iran, and all those other countries.
Yes, and now that you mentioned that, it's so ironic, like this visit comes as the Islamic Republic, Iran, looks to circumvent American sanctions, which Zimbabwe has also been a victim of for over two decades. So there is a big similarity, that thing in common.
Yes, so I think it would be a case of just probably finding solace in each other and how best the countries can survive the sanctions, or weather the sanctions, rather. While the diplomatic relations started a bit later when Zimbabwe was established, Iran is among the countries that supported Zimbabwe in the liberation struggle. And in that long list that supported, you find also Russia was among those people, those countries that supported. And this was also acknowledged by the president at the tarmac today at the airport. The Iranian president arrived.
That was reporter Kuzai Zanowashi speaking with me from Harare. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir met in Cairo today with heads of states from Chad, Libya, Central African Republic, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Egypt to discuss how to end the conflict in Sudan. South Sudan's Foreign Minister Deng Dao Deng told VOA by phone from Cairo that the leaders resolved to negotiate a permanent ceasefire followed by inclusive negotiations to address the root cause of the crisis. Experts say Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, both enjoy foreign support. Neighboring Egypt backs Borhan, while the United Arab Emirates and Russia's Wagner mercenary group support Dagalo's efforts. Previous truce deals have been brokered by Saudi Arabia and the United States, but the East African bloc now seeks to take the lead as both Egypt and Ethiopia push the warring sides to reach an agreement to stop the fighting. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi the role of external players in extending the war in Sudan.
Well, it is an ongoing concern, and it's been one of the troubling factors about the Sudan conflict from the beginning. There are many external actors that have interest in Sudan, in addition to Egypt and United Arab Emirates. You know, there's Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and you mentioned Russia. And, you know, there's limited evidence right now that there have been significant flows of weapons or resources from these external actors into Sudan. That's not to say that it isn't happening. But the uncertainty about what other foreign actors might do is ramping up the tensions in the region, and it's creating more incentives for others to jump in lest they get sidelined. And so it really points to the importance of trying to get to a ceasefire and a political settlement sooner rather than later, because the longer this goes on, the more likely it is that some foreign actor is going to jump in, try to take advantage of the situation and tilt things in a way that's going to be beneficial to them and increase tensions elsewhere in the region. And, you know, as part of this, it bears reminding that it's, you know, highly important to bring in the civilian Sudanese actors. They represent the vast majority of Sudanese. This conflict is between two military factions who have very little popular support. So really to find a solution that will be palatable domestically, as well as to be non-threatening to regional actors, you need the civilians to be at the front and center.
Previous truce deals have been brokered by Saudi Arabia and the United States, but the East African bloc now seeks to take the lead, while both Egypt and Ethiopia are trying to have the warring sides meet face-to-face. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Molly Fee, traveled to Addis Ababa to meet with the African leaders and Sudanese civilians on how to end the conflict in Sudan. Who can really be an honest broker capable of convincing the two sides that there is no military solution in Sudan?
There's a number of honest brokers out there. Many of the African countries and agencies that are involved in trying to find a resolution, the United Nations, the European actors, the U.S., all of these actors don't pose a territorial threat to Sudan. They're not threatening its sovereignty. So there are plenty of honest brokers that can be a platform. The tougher issue is how to convince the two sides that it's in their interest to find a solution, because each side still believes, and I think this is especially true for Hemeti and the Rapid Support Forces, you know, they believe they can still win militarily, or at least outlast the other in a war of attrition. And by doing so, it risks just further grinding the country into an abyss that will be very hard to pull out of, not to mention all the humanitarian costs that are involved. I think in terms of really convincing Hemeti and the Sudan Armed Forces, it's going to require a collection of voices that are reinforcing the message that there isn't a military victory to be won in Sudan. You know, even if one side were to prevail, it needs to be conveyed that they would not be recognized as the new sovereign representative in Sudan. It needs to be reiterated that, you know, the military did not enjoy the support and confidence of international actors prior to the conflict. So it's not going to come after they've taken the country down this path. And it's that international investment, that donor support, that debt relief, that's what's going to stabilize Sudan's economy and help it really regain some sort of normal status. And, you know, the military just doesn't have any credibility on that front. So I think, you know, that message needs to be reinforced from all international actors. I think the UAE, some of the Gulf states have a particularly important role here to make that point known that, you know, even though they may be supportive one side or the other, that it's really in the interest of those individuals, of the factions and the region, for both sides to seek some sort of negotiated settlement. And until they do, you know, they should be isolated and not receive any support politically in terms of weapons or resources.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number, +1202-258-3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a report we did that mattered to you. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa, or tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. That number, again, is +1202-258-3076. Tell us your name and where you live, and you might hear your comments on our shows. And thanks for 60 years of support. Former Mozambican Finance Minister Manuel Chang is set to be arraigned in a U.S. court today following his extradition on corruption charges. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg, South Africa, on the case that triggered the financial crisis in Mozambique and a warrant for his arrest.
Mozambique's former finance minister was put on a U.S. plane Tuesday and flown from South Africa to New York, where he will face charges of fraud and money laundering. Manuel Chang was wanted for his alleged role in a $2 billion graft scandal that plunged Mozambique into financial crisis. He was arrested in South Africa in 2018 on a U.S. government warrant. Years of legal wrangling over whether to send him back home or to the United States followed. Crispin Peary is a spokesman for South Africa's justice minister.
His surrender follows a protracted legal process in the South African courts, which ranged from the magistrate court right up to the Constitutional Court of South Africa, where ultimately the leave of appeal by the Republic of Mozambican government was denied. Mr. Chang will now stand trial in the United States of America on a number of charges.
Chang is accused of taking millions of dollars in bribes to secure unconstitutional loans from international banks for state-owned companies. The loans were for maritime projects, such as a tuna fishing fleet, in what became known as the hidden debt or tuna scandal. The U.S. government says American investors were among the fraud victims. When the amount of debt was discovered in 2016, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund pulled support from Mozambique, one of the world's poorest countries. About $500 million is still unaccounted for and alleged to have gone to kickbacks. Chang has denied any wrongdoing. Adriana Navungo is a Mozambican activist and chair of Forum de Monitoria do Somento, a civil society group. His group filed the court challenges that led to Chang being sent to the US instead of back to Mozambique.
We celebrate Mr. Chang's extradition to the United States. We celebrate mainly because his extradition has a strong political significance for the people of Mozambique. It means the triumph of justice over impunity.
Ahead of the extradition, Mozambique's government restated it wanted Chang tried at home. A Maputo court last year sentenced the son of former president Armando Guebuza and 10 others to between 10 and 12 years in prison over the scandal. But Navunga believes the former finance minister, who belongs to the same political party as current president Philip Nyusi, would have been given preferential treatment if sent to Mozambique.
So pushing for him to go to America is not because we lack America. It's because we want him to face justice in a court where he will be treated like a criminal, like a normal citizen, not like a minister.
Navunga said he hopes that during the trial, Chang will reveal who gave him the orders to sign the unconstitutional bonds and where to find Mozambique's missing $500 million. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The International Committee for the Red Cross says 80% of Africans facing food insecurity are affected by conflict. In a statement today after the release of the UN report on the state of the food security in the world, the ICRC's Africa director, Patrick Yusuf, attributed hunger in the Sahel to drought and climate crisis. He said in Burkina Faso alone, 3.5 million people are in need of food assistance. In Somalia, in East Africa, he says, the youngest and most vulnerable are threatened by the worst drought in years, combined with conflict and violence. Yusuf says hunger and the malnutrition are likely to worsen this year as conflicts and the climate crisis continues to grow. The ICRC will continue to provide food, treatment for malnutrition and other relief, but he says it cannot meet all of the challenges alone. UN experts today condemned Ethiopia's summary expulsion of hundreds of Eritreans at the end of June. They are urging a halt to any further deportations and an end to continuing reports of arbitrary detention of Eritrean refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights says collective expulsions are prohibited under the international law without a risk assessment of their exposure to human rights violations, including torture and enforced disappearances. The UN says several cases of family separation have been reported following the mass deportations, with parents forced back to Eritrea and children left behind in Ethiopia. Experts say they are seeking information on the fate or whereabouts of those deported since their return to Eritrea. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays,